Firstly, may I say it's a great joy to be here. I was here last year, if you remember, with my friend Barry, and it was a good day then. Well, for me it was, I can't speak for you. But it's good to be here, and we do pray for you. There's a number of churches that we do bear up each Lord's Day, and you're one of them, and we do pray that God will bless you. And when I pray that empty seats may be filled, I don't mean that purely for numbers. I don't like the numbers game. It's a very false yardstick. But more from the point of view of God's tokens of blessing towards you. And the older I get and the older you get, I'm sure you'll say something like this, that smaller tokens assume a greater blessing. When you're young Christians, it has to be something big to make you feel blessed. But the older you get, little tokens seem so much more wonderful, don't they? So be encouraged. We do pray for you. And our little fellowship in Erith is a blessing. We're very encouraged. Good man. He's a very faithful man. He's an authorised worship man. But he's a very good pastor and a very humble man. He's a good brother. And I value his fellowship very, very much. And God is bringing in people and conversions. And we're small, but like yourself, preaching the truth. And that's all we can do, isn't it? Pray and preach the truth and leave the rest to God. Well, this morning I'd like us to consider part of Esther chapter 6. And in a sense, I'd like to look at the very first verse, which seems a very strange verse. And if you read the book of Esther, which I've done many times, and it's a lovely book, it's a most understudied book and a most ill-understood book. But in the very first verse, we read this: on that night could not the king sleep. Well, that sounds rather strange. That's my verse. You think, well, what a strange verse to take. But again, if I understand the correct rules of exposition, you have to look at the context. And to look at the context in which that verse is placed, you must look at the preceding five chapters to in any way come to a correct assessment of what that verse implies and means. And it's the whole of the book of Esther hinges on this one verse, seemingly. We cannot fully understand this chapter or its significance unless we are clear as to what has gone on before in the book of Esther. Why was Mordecai about to be honoured? What had he done that had brought King Ahasuerus to this situation where he was going to honour this Jewish slave who sat at the king's gate? What had he done? What had he done? And more importantly, what was God doing? What was God doing? Well, let us quickly introduce ourselves to the events leading up to this point by way of introduction. It's a fairly lengthy introduction, but it's necessary. What does the book of Esther teach us? Who are the important characters within the book? What are the biblical principles? These are points we have to understand to come to a correct understanding of the Word of God. You remember, of course, that the name of God is not once mentioned throughout the whole book of Esther. Some have therefore concluded that this is not to be included in canon. I don't accept that. Martin Luther said this about the book of Esther: I am so hostile to this book that I wish it did not exist. That's the great reformer. For it Judaizes too much and has too much heathen naughtiness. That's what Martin Luther said. Now, of course, we have to see dear Martin Luther in context. He was coming out of 1,000 years of darkness, and God did marvellous things with him. But he hadn't come into full truth, had he? There were still the last vestiges of the old Roman Catholic dogma. And, of course, he was anti-Semitic. Interesting, too, by way of just general consideration, the book of Esther contains no miracles. There's not one miracle mentioned. Not, as it were, overtly. Regarding inspiration, the Hebrew version of Esther has always been accepted as canon. The early church fathers and throughout the history of the Christian church, the Hebrew version of Esther has always been accepted as canon. It had the approval of the early church fathers, the early Jewish fathers, and therefore there's been no question of it. It's said that Moses wrote the book. That's the general consensus. Now, there was a second book of Esther written. You may have known that too, but it was in Greek. And the Greek version sought to remedy the seeming omission of the name of God not being included in the book of Esther. In the Greek version, there was the name of God included. This version, the Greek version, was never accepted as being canon. What is the main theme of the book of Esther? We're just dealing with the sort of the headings, if you wish. What is the main theme of the book of Esther? Well, it's this. It is simply this: the providence of God. The providence of God means God showing foreseeing care for his creatures. Isn't that wonderful? God showing foreseeing care for his creatures. In other words, God moving, God intervening, God controlling events, firstly, of course, for his own glory, and then for the blessing and for the nurture and preservation of his people. Dear friends and brethren, why are we here this morning? Have we some miraculous powers that keep us in the way of the Christian? Well, of course we don't. We are kept by God, aren't we? Was it Dr. Martin Lloyd Jones? I may quote him too many times, but I don't do too much to miss to quote him. He said this: not my feeble grasp of him, but his mighty grasp of me. And if we're Christians at all this morning, we can all say amen to that, can't we? John Flavel said, who was a Puritan who came from this part of the world, I understand, he said this: he who observes providence will never be long without providence to observe. It's interesting. In the book of Esther, we see two main races: the Jews, and they're depicted as being despised under the bondage of slavery. They're in a foreign land because of their idolatry. And the Persian Empire, an empire of some 127 provinces. And at the head of this empire is this despotic king called King Ahasuerus. How the Jews here picture what we see around us today. The Christian church is stumbling, isn't it? I dread to think of the number of churches I've seen close. Where I lived in South London for many years, I could count probably between 45 and 50 churches that used to be there, they've now gone. But more worryingly, what is happening within the so-called Christian church? What error there seems to be abounding within the church? Do you know, we were at a Grace Baptist meeting recently, and one pastor said this: he should have been ashamed. This was his subject for prayer. Will you please pray that God will bless the newly formed art class? Amazing. God has chosen the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Not art, not mime, not drama, not music. The church appears weak and persecuted, and we're tempted to fear, are we not? There's not one person here, I don't believe, who's not in some way tempted to fear what will happen for the future. If you have children, what's happening to the church? And here, I believe, is the great theme of the book of Esther. And it's this: for your encouragement, when all seems lost, when all seems at its very lowest ebb, when all seems to be beyond the power of man, God intervenes. That's the principle. The Lord reigns, and the hearts of kings are in his hand. Do you fear the rise of Islam? Some years ago, it was Roman Catholic dogma seemed to hold sway. Communism, they come and they go. Our God reigns. Well, then, who are the main characters of this book? And what events unfold to prove this principle of God's providence? Well, consider this king, King Ahasuerus. He's a tyrant, a despotic ruler over 127 provinces, also known as Xerxes. He has what can best be determined as unlimited power. He has an army of over 2 million men. He has a vast empire. And then we see his second in command, Haman, second only to the king. He's a Jew hater. Why did he hate the Jews so much? Why did he detest this man Mordecai so much? Why did he seem to single out Mordecai above all the rest of the Jews so significantly? Well, you remember, go back, King Agag. Remember when Samuel said to Saul, slay him. Be careful, slay him. And when Samuel came, there's Agag, and Saul said, I've done all that you told me to do. He said, no, you haven't. And then we read, Samuel hewed Agag to pieces. Haman was a descendant of Agag. That's the point where he hates the Jews. This is the reason Haman hated Mordecai, because he was a Jew. And then we cannot deal with the first five verses without touching on to the reason why Mordecai is here and why his niece Esther is in the palace. Remember the incident? There's an orgy of 180 days. It's a party. It's a drunken feast. And Shushan is awash with lords and the princes of the lands. And there is just simply a drunken orgy for 180 days. And in the midst of this, King Ahasuerus, for some inexplicable reason, is emboldened to ask his wife, Queen Vashti, to come out and parade herself amongst this drunken assembly. Now, I think she was a chaste woman and a virtuous woman, and she refused to do that, quite rightly so. And Queen Vashti refuses, and as a consequence, she is taken from the throne. She's no longer the queen. And another queen has to be selected in her place. And you remember how that, and I don't understand this, this must be the providence of God. What on earth induced godly Mordecai to put forward his beloved niece, Esther, to the queenship? We couldn't do it, could we? It would be unthinkable, wouldn't it? This despotic king, and to send our cherished niece to be presented as a possible queen. Now, I don't understand what was going on in Mordecai's head, but such is the providence of God. And then we see godly Mordecai. He's a slave. He said he may have been a eunuch. And where is he? Throughout the book of Esther, you see this little expression again and again, sitting at the king's gate. What's that imply? Well, let me just tell you this. He's a slave in a foreign land. He's a godly Jew. And the Jews are being chastened because of their idolatry. Remember, after the Babylonian idolatry, the idolatry never once mentioned against the Jews, amongst the Jews. It's remedied once and for all. But here is Mordecai. He's sitting at the king's gate. He's a man of God. And he is being faithful to this despotic king in a foreign land because that's his Christian duty. Christians should be exemplary employees. Honest. Men and women of integrity. Men and women who can be depended upon. And what takes place? In chapter 2, verses 21 and 23, Mordecai hears of a plan of two of the king's chamberlains, Teresh and Bigthana. And they're planning to assassinate the king. And Mordecai hears this. He's a faithful servant of the king. So he simply informs Esther, who's now the queen, to tell King Ahasuerus there is a plot afoot to have him assassinated. And the plot is found to be correct. And the king, therefore, hangs Teresh and Bigthana, these chamberlains. Now, that's the background. That's what's gone on before. And as a consequence, Mordecai, the king's servant, is at the gate. He saved the king's life. And we come back to chapter 6. But he has been forgotten. Forgotten. Do you sometimes feel that you've been forgotten? Yeah? Do you sometimes raise in your heart, perhaps on your lips, Lord, why haven't I had this or that or this? Lord, why me? When things go contrary to you, why me, Lord? I'm doing my best. My friend, why not you? We deserve nothing, do we? Nothing. We have received everything. Everything. And, you know, with that lovely hymn by Wesley when it says, till we cast our crowns before thee, lost in wonder, love and praise. That single event will more than recompense for any affliction you or I may have throughout this tiresome and weary earthly pilgrimage, won't it? Do you believe that? Because that's the reality of it. Mordecai is forgotten. He obtains no reward from the king. He saved the king's life. He should be honoured, but he's not. Notice this, he's not bitter. What does he do? He continues at the king's gate. Now, brethren, you're here, aren't you? This is where God has placed you. This is your place of Christian service, and dare I say, at the risk of being perhaps duty. I love the word duty, don't you? Duty. Reliability. Standing where you should be. Being where God has placed you. Being at the place of duty and service. That's not easy. We have too many Christian nomads today. We want men and women of God who stand where God has placed them. That was Mordecai. Now here he is. Does he feel forgotten? Not at all. Does he feel hard done by? Not at all. He goes back to the place of service. Then notice how the path of duty brought further trouble on Mordecai. In chapter 3, King Ahasuerus makes an absurd promise to Haman. Haman hates the Jews so intensely that he hatches a plan. And he says to the king, if you allow me to exterminate all the Jews on a certain day, I will give you 10,000 talents of silver. Now, put that in context. That's 275 tons of silver, which was equivalent, if my memory serves me correctly, of 2/3 of the annual revenue of the whole of the 127 provinces. Now, think about that. Haman's hatred is so intense, primarily for Mordecai, that he promises the annual revenue, 2/3 of it, for these 127 provinces, to the king, if he can just get a letter, as it were, a death warrant. And he gets it. The king, of course, is a man of avarice and greed, and he goes along with it. The decree is made. Remember, we have that expression, it's written in the laws of the Medes and Persians. You can't break it. This cannot be broken. Don't forget God. Haman, proud, arrogant, ambitious, has reached great heights. And history tells us that Haman was not only an evil man, but a cruel man, using his power in a most disgraceful way. Well, then look again at Haman and Mordecai. How different. The man of God pictured as the one under the hammer, as it were. And Christians are invariably like that, aren't they? We're treated as fools. We might be, as it were, bright and intelligent in our jobs and other things, but we are treated as second rate because we believe in the eternal God and his unchanging word. We are children, if you wish, aren't we? Childlike faith, but we believe our God. Suddenly, the decree is also passed that at a certain time, when Haman passes by, everyone has to bow. Well, of course, dear old Mordecai, you know what he's going to do. He can't bow, can he? Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and Daniel is the same. The principles are the same. Mordecai, this man of principle, refuses to bow, and suddenly the man who saved the king's life is now in danger of losing his own because of obedience, now to God. It could be said of Mordecai, seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not. I have to say this. One of the greatest dangers of the Christian ministry today is self-seeking and wanting elevation. I've got to be very careful what I say, not because of present company, I assure you, but the whole principle. There is this onwards and upwards mentality in the Christian ministry, isn't there? Have you spoken at this conference? Or have you spoken at that conference? It reeks, it really does. It's fleshly. How big is your church? How big are your baptismal classes? All this sort of stupid talk. Men called of God to preach the gospel are called to be faithful. Leave God to give the results. Be thou faithful. That's what's required. Compare Mordecai, the man of God, with Haman, the man that loved the praise of men. The incident is one of the major points in God's providential dealings with his people. Notice, the other servants bowed down, but not Mordecai. Now, where are the men of principle today? Where are the men who will adhere to this book? Who will adhere to the old paths? Who will not give in to pressure? I'm hearing increasingly men, well-intentioned many of them, but they've lost their way. You need to engage in this sort of activity. We need to engage in that sort of activity. One man said this, a minister said this, I advise ministers to join the local health club as a means of outreach to bring people to the church. Well, why don't we have prayer anymore? Why don't we get on our knees and pray that God would bring in the lost? That God will revive his work in the midst of you. Have we forgotten what prayer is? Mordecai, I feared God more than man. If I should be the servant of man, I would not be the servant of God. And with Mordecai, we see actions speak louder than words. Now, Mordecai was such a man. You know, the little chorus, dare to be a Daniel. Dare to stand alone, dare to have a purpose true and dare to make it known. There's Mordecai. You know, if you have two or three people in a church of this calibre, you know, it makes a difference, doesn't it? They're reliable. You know, they're praying. You know, they're going to be there. You know, their heart's in the work. You know, they want the work to prosper and they're reliable. Now, the anger of Mordecai, of Haman, is increased. Mordecai refuses to bow. Look at what he plans. 10,000 talents of the king. The death warrant of all the Jews on a certain day. A decree is written and sealed by the king. And it was said that it would take less than 1 month for this decree to reach all the furthest borders of the 127 provinces. It's done. It cannot be changed. This is Mordecai's evil day. Have you ever had an evil day? Ephesians 6, evil day. Give me Christians who know what it is to have an evil day and who come through it and who triumph. They're different. They've proven God. They've relied upon God in the darkness when God seems distant, when the heavens seem as a sounding brass. They're the Christians you want. Tried and tested and faithful Christians. Mordecai was such a man. Now here's his evil day, but things go from bad to worse. And this is oftentimes God's way of dealing with us, isn't it? We think the situation we're in is bad enough, but around the corner there's something worse. Can you imagine what's being said about Mordecai? You know, why didn't you bow to Haman? It was only a little thing. Because of you not bowing, there's a decree going round that all of the Jews will be exterminated because of you. You know, we can be victimised, can't we? By being faithful. Not by the world, but by other Christians. Consider what Mordecai had done. He cannot bow down to Haman. He stood against the king's favourite, Haman. He possibly jeopardised his beloved Esther. He risked death with the king's hand. He endangered the whole of the Jewish nation by this simple act of obedience to God. Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Does that seem too extreme? This is how God works. Mordecai is utterly consistent. And I say this, this should be the hallmark of every child of God. Predictability. Consistency. In other words, you know how they will react in any set of given circumstances. They're predictable. I thank God that I've known men and still know them. And I bless God for every remembrance of them. You know what they're going to say. You know what they're going to do. Whatever the situation they may be in, they're faithful. You can't turn them. They're men of God. You can't buy them. But things go worse. This decree is sent. The death sentence is official. The Jews are to await slaughter. Now, Haman knows no bounds. He's now taken it upon himself to build a gallows of some 75 feet high. In his back garden, he's got the king's ear. I mean, isn't it amazing? And this is human nature at its worst, isn't it? A man can have everything. And I've known men, moguls in industry, multi-millionaires. They've got everything they could ever wish for. Yet they haven't got this one little thing. And their whole life is marred by this one little thing they haven't got. How wretched is fallen nature? This is Haman. He's second only to the king. Over 127 provinces. He's a wealthy man. He's got position, power, authority. But he hasn't got this poor, godly man to bow before him. And that makes his rage so much the worse. So he builds a gallows. And here, picture this if you can. There's dear Mordecai. He's sitting at the king's gate. He's waiting death. He is the butt of all the Jews now saying to him, "You are the cause of all our trouble. If only, Mordecai, you weren't so keen on your doctrine. If only you wouldn't keep to those old paths. If only you didn't do that. Ease up a bit. Take it easy. Lighten up a bit." We're hearing it today, aren't we? Aren't we? In the church? "You're too rigid. You're old-fashioned. Change a version of the Bible. A bit more music. You have the children dancing. And a bit of few." You see what I mean? The principles are the same, aren't they? Here's Mordecai. He's hearing the gallows being built. Imagine it. The hammer on the nail. He can see it going up. And he knows he's going to be on that gallows, humanly speaking, very soon. Why doesn't he run away? He's a man of God. You see? He remains at the king's gate, at the place of duty. May I say this? God's ways are not our ways, are they? What do you and I do when we're faced with impossible situations? Panic? Run to this man? Run to that man? Again, if I might quote dear Dr. Lloyd-Jones, he said, "If you get on your knees and you unburden your problem to God, if you get up and that problem is still whirling around your brain, you haven't prayed correctly." Easier said than done, isn't it? There's Mordecai, and the Jews are in sackcloth and ashes. The gallows is being built. Haman has now got the king's ear. It seems to have the queen's ear. There's going to be a special feast, which is the guest of honour. What will happen to Mordecai? Well, it's obvious, humanly speaking. Consider this. What harm had Mordecai done to Haman? What slight had he given? Simply, he didn't bow down. Now, God's providence, as I must come to a close, continues to unfold. The Jews are praying and fasting. Esther has approached the king and hazarded her life. The day of extermination is nearer. Haman is gloating. The gallows are going up. Haman can go no higher. The feast is arranged. The king, the queen, and Haman there. He's reached the pinnacle. Haman appears to have won. But where is godly Mordecai? Well, you know, don't you? He's at the gate. That's the predictability, which is so wonderful. Now, I have to raise this. A but God. Thank God for the buts of Scripture. On that night, well, what night? The very night that Haman is coming to the king to ask him to give him Haman to put on the gallows. On that very night, it was said by commentators, if I understand correctly, that the time lapse between Mordecai saving the king's life was about 6 years. 6 years to be forgotten. And now, on that night, King Ahasuerus can't sleep. I don't think they had Valium in those days, or whatever, they had the sleeping draughts. When Saul was perplexed, he asked for his musicians, didn't he? David to play the harp. But what a thing to do. I suppose the equivalent would be the prime minister of our land asking, on a night he couldn't sleep, for one of his officers to go and get Hansard. "Read to me the transcripts of Parliament." That would drive him to sleep, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? Just, you know, what these MPs have said, "My honourable gentleman, this sort of nonsense." Well, get me Hansard. And that's what he did. So he got the chronicle. But there's a wonder of God's providence. How God controls, isn't he? At the very place that, hey, as you heirs have forgotten, the chamberlain opens the page to this act, this glorious act some 6 years previous, when Mordecai saved the king's life. Now, that sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? Does it? My friends, this is the activity of God. How God acts. When all seems lost, at the 11th hour. And what does he say? Well, what shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honour? And there's Mordecai knows nothing of this. He's at the gate. He's in sackcloth and ashes. Haman comes in. Ah, well, it's me. The crown, the horse, the apparel. That's what I want. I can go no higher, but that's what I want. Well, Haman, do that for Mordecai. Can you imagine that? Crashing down. Now, I say it sounds too good to be true, but it isn't. And this is how God delights to work. He brings men to an end of themselves. To make men realise it's not of their doing, but his. That's the principle here. So Haman, with his head bowed, has to lead this detested Jew on the king's horse through the streets of Babylon or Shushan, saying, "Thus shall it be done unto the man whom the king delighted to honour." And then he does it. Now, here's a little point again. When Mordecai dismounts, where does he go? Back to the gate. This elevation didn't go to his head. Some Christians can't take promotion, can they? It goes to their head. It changes them. Some Christians can't take being wealthy. It changes them. Adversely. And Mordecai came again to the king's gate. And he continues again in the path of Judah, coming to an end. God's vindication goes even further. Haman is soon to be humbled. The terrible scheme is soon to backfire. Haman's plan of extermination is discovered. And the very gallows that he is being built, that being built to kill dear Mordecai, will be used to take his own life. How are the mighty fallen? I understand there's a program starting this coming week on the television, Richard Dawkins. Don't they speak with such authority? People of now are aware there is no God. They say it with such dogmatism, don't they? And do not, they seem to hold sway. The people are just deluded by it. It takes more faith to believe in evolution than it does to believe in Genesis, doesn't it, really? But these men set themselves up. And dare I say, they fall. And great will be their fall. Don't fear them. Don't fear them. God's in control. We tend to want to do God's work for him, don't we? We don't have to. We're called to be faithful. Be thou faithful. Be at the gate. Be in the fellowship. Be obedient. Be involved in God's work. God will do the rest. Now, Mordecai is elevated. Haman is hung on the very gallows that he built for this man of God. Now let me round it up and see what principles we must come to as we conclude. God continued not only to spare his people by a miraculous deliverance. On the day the appointed death or extermination of the Jews, there was this amazing reversal of fortunes, and the Jews were spared. Chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, I think it is, isn't it? It says this: "The Jews gathered themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt, and no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all people. And all the rulers of the provinces and lieutenants and the deputies and officers of the kings helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them." There you have it. There you have it. The Feast of Purim is celebrated today by the Jews. the Feast of Purim being this very deliverance of the Jews that we see here in the book of Esther. It's celebrated today. So we have historical confirmation that this actually took place. Well, let's bring it nearer home as I close. What we see in the book of Esther, and such a quick cursory look at it, is but, I believe, a picture of Christian experience. If you wish, the outworking of God's providential dealings. Sometimes unnoticed, sometimes unfelt, but ever present. Do you believe that? Ever present. God's plans are unfolding. We don't know. Who could have believed in 1348, was it, that when the plague came to the shores of Britain, that a 25-year-old man, John Wycliffe, will be so affected by the plague that was the beginning of the Reformation. One little man. One man. See how God works? A nondescript. 1,000 years of darkness. But God raises up one man and he uses the amazing event of the plague coming to Britain to bring this man to tremendous faith. And that fact of the plague coming to Britain never, ever left John Wycliffe. He was in his ministry. He preached about it as an instance of God's judgment and men being ready for it. It's how God works. Piece by piece, day by day. 5-6 years, he's forgotten. But God's plans are working, definitely. Not missing a beat. Minute detail. The world calls it luck. Chance. They say courtesy of serendipity, whatever that means. But we as believers know it as the providence of Almighty God. When things go wrong, badly wrong, Romans 8:28, when all seems to be hopeless and helpless, we see in the past, as God delivers his people, all those things in the light of his providence. Look again at Mordecai. How fearful his condition. Who would change places with him? No one. Trials, disappointments, losses, afflictions, persecutions, all come to you and all come to me and all come to churches in the providence of God. You cannot get a more desperate situation. But then look at chapter 9. How amazing the transformation. There's no comparison. He's elevated. King Ahasuerus elevates him to Haman's position. He's held in great honour and esteem. Let me spiritualize it as I close. God's providence, his dealings with you and I, no matter how dark and sometimes traumatic they may be, will bring us to ultimate glory. Do you believe that? Ultimate glory. Nothing can stop it. Nothing. Whatever God does is perfect. Francis Ridley Havergal said, Lord, I want to serve and run for thee. And he said to her, no, you'll lay on a bed of sickness and suffer. God's providence. Different for you, different for me. But it's perfect for you, and it's perfect for me. If God be for us, who can be against us? And the same providence that delivered Mordecai and the Jews, God has promised to deliver you and to deliver me. It's the same providence that will keep and protect God's people. We are a remnant. We are an afflicted remnant. We may be confronted with the manifold temptations. Here is the real message of this book of Esther. When all seems lost, when we're tempted to lose heart, when we think we can go no further, when we think we're at our very end, God intervenes. Now, brethren, you have to believe that. Can't be done for you. This is the life of faith. What an encouragement, isn't it? And here's the very last encouragement I give. And I must end on this. God is unchanging. Isn't he? He cannot change. It's impossible for him to change. He has promised never to change. And if you like a but see in the heavenlies, how precious one believer is to Almighty God. If the angels in heaven rejoice with joy unspeakable over one sinner that repents, what joy there must be in heaven as God beholds his languishing people who are languishing in his providence, who are allowed to suffer for a season, if need be, for their own ultimate sanctification and growth in grace, and of course, for his ultimate glory. But nonetheless, whatever trials and tribulations and pains we may endure are ultimately, brethren, for our ultimate good and glory, and more importantly, for his glory. What a God. Isn't he faithful? Don't doubt him. Don't question his promises. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. Well, maybe learn those simple lessons to the glory of God.